After the noise had died down, we went to find out what we could. Men had grouped themselves in shell holes to get what shelter they could, but there was no organisation left, and all we could do was get the groups in touch with each other and pull some back and push others forward to make some sort of coherent line and evacuate as many wounded as we could. Even this activity had to stop when dawn came, as one could not move about in daylight up at the front. These were the words spoken by one of the survivors, what has become known as the Moonlight Massacre, a nighttime attack on German defences on the Passchendaele Ridge in the early hours of 2nd of December 1917. And in this week's podcast, which I call Tales from the Battlefields, we talk to the author and historian, Michael Lokeriko, and he explains exactly what happened in that battle. So without any more ado, let's get on to my chat with Michael, and we'll find out exactly what happened in this, what's often referred to as a forgotten action on the Passchendaele battlefield. What got you inspired in the first place in World War One? Was it the American involvement, or was it not until you came to the UK?
No, you know, I read Martin Middlebrook's The First Day on the Somme.
Right.
And I became an Anglophile. That's what happened.
Yeah, that was before you came to the UK, was it, or when you arrived here?
Yeah, this would have been back in the 80s, I think.
Oh, right, as long ago as that.
And I became an Anglophile, and, you know, in those days, you know, you couldn't find the books quite easily, so I laid out a good sum of money to buy all of the official histories, you know, original. They weren't reprinting them yet. They weren't available on CD-ROM, you know, but it was, you know, there wasn't a lot. It's not like now where there are so many books.
Yeah.
Back then, a lot of what you had was from the 50th anniversary and an occasional volume here and there, but not the kind of interest that I think before the centenary, which is a little different. And what we have now, people like us, you know, that will always have an interest in the Great War. It won't be the flavor of the month.
No, it doesn't go away, does it? And I think it's what I've learned, you know, while I've been doing these podcasts the last 18 months or so, I've learned a lot. But what I've learned is that the interest in it seems to be increasing, not decreasing. You know, a number of people said, oh, it's going to fade away after centenary. And obviously we then had COVID, but it hasn't. It's, you know, I don't know about you, but I'm busier than ever, you know, dealing with inquiries and interest about it.
Well, you know, I certainly said, I remember that I heard those pundits, oh, you know, now that it's done with it, I thought, well, not for me.
No.
I was interested in it before the centenary and, you know, and I'll certainly be interested in it after that. So it's, I just have a real passion. You might even say an obsession for the Great War. And I'm not alone, you know, but I went from, you know, I'm not affiliated with a university, but I went from an enthusiast to an academic historian.
Well, you've gone from one extreme to the other, haven't you?
but being an enthusiast, I think, helps. I still remember, I couldn't tell you the name of this person, but when I was doing my degree at Birmingham, there was somebody that I spoke to. They were doing history degree, but not anything with military history of the First World War. And this person asked me, well, what are you doing your thesis on? And I told him. I said, well, you know, out of courtesy, I said, well, tell me about yours. And he told me, and I said, oh, I said, why did you choose that topic? And he said, well, I didn't really choose it. My advisor assigned it to me.
Right.
And I could never work that way.
Oh,
I
mean, you wouldn't have the interest, would you, or the enthusiasm if you did it that way?
No. And to me, you know, these men, when I arrived here in 2007 in the circle that, you know, I moved in at that time where you met, you know, and you'd go to seminars and conferences and whatever. And people would ask me, well, what are you writing about? And I would tell them.
Yeah.
And they never heard of it.
Well,
they never heard of it.
So what was it then? What was it that made you wake up one day and thought, right, I'm an academic and I'm going to write about my thesis and then go on to write a book about the Moonlight Massacre, which is what we're talking about today. What inspired you? I mean, everyone talks about the Battle of Passchendaele, Third Battle of Eight, and all the rest of it. But normally our interest stops in the middle of November. But you're now taking this. Tell us a little bit about why you decided to do that, and then we'll talk about the battle itself.
I was at Ypres, and I have good friends there that I would stay with on the Messines Ridge. And one day I was in Ypres just spending the day walking around, and there was a, I don't think it exists anymore, there was a bed and breakfast that also had a secondhand bookshop on the lower level called the Shell Hole.
The Shell Hole. That was that back. It was a, was he a paratrooper or something, wasn't he?
Yes, he was an
Yes,
ex.
I remember
He's an
him.
ex. He was an ex-para. That is
That's it.
absolutely right.
Yeah,
Yes,
he was quite a character, wasn't
he was. He was very nice. I think some people were a little put off. They thought he was surly, but I found him to be a pretty nice guy, actually. In any case, I was doing a shelf browse, and I came across. You may or may not have seen this, but the History of the 8th Division by Boorstin and Bax. That was published in 1926. And I just randomly opened it up, and there was a map. And it said Passchendaele, 1st and 2nd December 1917. And I went, what? What's this all about? You know? And so I went out that way the next day, and I remember standing at what was known on the British maps as Vindictive Crossroads, which is now Vindictive Roundabout. Okay. And looking east and thinking to myself, well, it happened around here. And then, of course, I knew from the 8th Division account that the 32nd Division was involved on the left. But from my vantage point, it was very difficult for me to discern anything about the battlefield as it was at that time or even today. It took a number of visits to get my head around all of that. But that's how I first came upon the operation. And
And who came up with the term the Moonlight Massacre?
well, that's a very good question. And it's interesting how many people mix it up with the Midnight Massacre. In fact, my book's been referred to that a couple of times.
Yes, I
But
could imagine,
Moonlight Massacre is not a term that I came up with. It's in the one of the battalions that were involved was the 16th Highland Light Infantry. They have a very good history. One of the chapters is entitled The Moonlight Massacre, and it's about that operation. And so that's why I chose
Ah,
that.
right. That's where it came from. So if we then start to talk about the battle itself,
2nd of December, 1917.
2nd of December 1917, it
Yes.
began, and it was only a couple of days, yeah, a couple of days it went on
It
for.
really it begins at the 0 hour at 1:55 a.m. and operations are shut down by the evening of the 3rd of December.
And why? Why did they, having closed down the Third Battle of Ypres, Passchendaele, the weather is set cold and horrible and nasty for the entire winter. Everyone goes back into their holes and recovers from the Battle of Passchendaele. And then some bright spark says, "Oh, come on, let's have another go at another German strong point, not far from Passchendaele itself." Why?
Well, the reasoning behind it was if you read in the British official history published in 1948 or the Canadian official history, it's claimed, and this is not to denigrate Canadian participation, it's understandable, but it's claimed that on the 10th of November, on the right, the Canadians who were attacking northeast of Passchendaele, that they gained all of their objectives. And yet, in the 2nd of December attack, there was an important feature by the standards of the Passchendaele Ridge, a bit of high ground. The highest point on the northern portion of the ridge is called Hill 52. In the 2nd of December attack, Hill 52 is an objective, but it was also an objective for the Canadians on the 10th of November. So if the Canadians captured on the 10th of November, how was it that it was in German hands in early December 1917?
They haven't gone that far the 10th
Ah.
of November. They've just gone to the other side of Passchendaele village and then stopped. Is that right?
Yes, beyond Vindictive Crossroads slightly, and then the 1st British Division on the left attacks a feature which I'll talk about in a moment called the Vat Cottage's Ridge. That's what it was referred to at the time. And so the importance of these two features, and but they're not the only one. With Hill 52 provided excellent observation, and the Canadians reported that it had been seized on the 10th of November. However, subsequent reconnaissance in the archives was tucked into a Second Army report, and it said that while the southern slopes of Hill 52 had been captured, the summit and the northeastern portion were still in German hands, and that is what you needed in order to overlook the German lines there. Now, on the left, just to the north of the Hudaberg Valley, is the Vat Cottage's ridge. And if you capture that, you can dominate the low ground in front of Polkapol, which is a swamp.
So this is all about observation then,
It's
taking this
all
back.
about observation,
I see.
absolutely.
Yeah.
There was also a German position now the on the right, and this is closer to Passchendaele Village.
Yeah.
And there were two redoubts that were connected by a single trench. There was the southern redoubt and the northern redoubt with a trench in between called Venison Trench. And the importance of these positions, and it's interesting about these because I couldn't figure out at this time why there was a bit of linear trench that the Germans were maintaining. Now, the reason that is, by that time they were practicing a tactic called the leerige Gefechtsfelde, if I'm pronouncing that correctly, means the hidden battlefield. So while they might be holding, we've all seen the photographs where it
Yeah.
looks like the surface of the moon with
Yeah.
shell hole upon shell hole.
Yeah.
Well, obviously they're holding a linear position there, but it's difficult to discern, especially if they cover it with sandbags and sheet iron and mud, the mud on their helmets and whatever.
So,
But they were holding to this piece with
just for the people amongst us, including me, who are not academics and not very bright, when you say a linear position, do you mean at right angles to the normal trenches, like a communication trench?
I mean a trench that you can discern from the air,
Right,
you
I
know,
see.
where it starts and where it ends.
Right.
Okay,
Yes.
that's what I mean. And
Excellent.
so Germans were holding this position, and it was really, you could see it from the air. I have many aerial photographs that were
Yes.
taken on. Okay, it had been part of when new recruits would come to join the German Fourth Army, they would be trained back there. But of course, by late 1917, it's now the front
This is the
line.
front line, yes, yeah.
And so I thought to myself, why are these two positions? I mean, why are these two redoubts and this linear trench? Why are the Germans holding this? And the way I found out was, is I was in a car going around the battlefield with a rental car,
Yeah.
and I went down the Dornkotterstraat, which is the name of the street, and I was heading up the slope to where, on my right would be the southern redoubt, and on my left would have ran Venison Trench.
Yeah.
And when I went a little past where those positions were, you could see into the valley to the east as far as Roeselare. All of this ground to the Germans, this Venison Trench and the two redoubts, Hill 52 and the Vat Cottage's Ridge, this was all vital ground for the Germans.
Yeah.
You know, it was like not one more step back.
So it should have
Okay.
been taken. It should have been taken during the main third Battle of Ypres, during the Battle of
Oh yeah.
Passchendaele. It wasn't because they just run out of steam, basically, didn't they? But then the senior officers, the generals, have looked at that and said, "We've got to take this before the winter really sets in. We've got to take this this high ground to stop the Germans from observing us. Otherwise, the Germans would have had a clear view of where the British and Canadians and Australians and New Zealanders were all the way through the winter, wouldn't they?"
Yeah, especially in that part of the ridge, because most of the ridge, with one exception farther south, is in British hands by then.
Yes.
But West Trosabika, at the very top of the ridge, okay, to the north, that's still in German hands. The Second Army, which is now under the command of Rawlinson, because
Yes.
Plumer has been sent to Italy, they have plans to continue operations throughout the winter to clear the ridge.
Right.
And then Rawlinson decides that they're only going to try and dominate West Trosabik, make it difficult, maybe make it almost untenable for the Germans. And then what happens is they decide that they're just going to, this operation just going to be a 2nd December operation that I read about, is going to be a local operation only. They will capture those good points of observation, and then that's going to be it. The offensive is shut down for the winter. But it was hoped that in the new year, and of course,
Yeah.
They were going to continue the offensive.
So
They had most of the ridge, and they were going to, launch
push on.
another attack into the Bruges Basin. And, as happened in 1918, the Germans would have to withdraw from the Flanders coast.
They'd have been 18 months ahead of themselves had the Germans not attacked. And is then that sounds like when we're talking about Rawlinson, like the bite and hold tactics that he'd come up with the previous year on the Somme?
Yeah, and also as an advocate of night attacks, as an army commander.
So I'm going to interrupt the interview there because we're talking about the strategic side of the battle and what the battlefield may have looked like when we look back retrospectively in history. But I've got here an account that was written by a Captain A. Fraser, who was part of the 97th Brigade. And this is how he described the battlefield in 1917. He said, "Those of us who stood on the high ground near Bellevue at 0 hour on that memorable morning will always retain a vivid impression of the fight. It was a very fine night and everything quiet on the front. The hillside on which we stood was bathed in moonlight, so it was difficult to realise that within a few moments some five battalions would be advancing across that dark patch down the valley and that the stillness of the night would be shattered by the rat-tat-tat of machine guns and the whine of high explosives. At 1:55 a.m. we knew our men had started and we were glad that for the next 2 minutes everything was quiet. Suddenly, at 2:03, came the sound of several enemy rifle shots, followed immediately by the ripple of machine guns all along the front. Up went the SOS on both flanks of the attack. Still, our artillery was silent. We knew that we could hope for no assistance from them until 3 minutes after the hour, and meantime, the enemy was having a free hand for 5 minutes on a target that looked grotesquely big against the bright moon." So why then at this stage then did they decide to do it at night? And were they supposed to use the moonlight?
And to, the commanders that we have, I think a lot of, for the 8th Corps, it's Hunter Weston of Gallipoli fame or infamy, depending upon your outlook.
Yeah,
yeah. The 2nd Corps is Claude Jacob. And the divisional commanders are for the 8th Division, Major General William Henniker. And for the 32nd Division, it's a difficult person to deal with. They both were actually.
Yeah.
Cameron Shute, General Cameron
Shute.
Yeah,
he's very famous, infamous.
And this attack was his brainchild.
Oh, right, okay.
At least the plan, and Henniker had to conform to it. And the problem was, is for the 32nd Division to seize Hill 52, which is right along the road between Passchendaele and West Rosebeke. They couldn't form up in daylight. They formed up, they'd be seen. Okay, and that'd be the end.
Yeah.
Okay. So Shute knew that once the Germans detected that the British were advancing or about to advance, they would launch a barrage on the British trenches and then move it forward to engage the target any of the troops moving towards their outposts and their main line of resistance. So he came up with this plan. For the first 8 minutes of the operation, there'd be no artillery barrage. And both divisions, and that they would advance with the bayonet silently and overrun the German outpost positions.
Yeah.
Okay. By the time they were on the main line of resistance, the Hill 52 and the Vat Cottages Ridge. So once they achieve those objectives, then the barrage would open to protect them as they were consolidating.
Okay.
Okay. Now, what's the importance of the moonlight? You think, well, you know, why would they attack under moonlight? I mean, it could be seen. You need some kind of relative light to maintain direction.
Otherwise, you won't know where you're going. You'll
be attacking in pitch dark.
Yeah.
And so the plan was approved by both corps commanders. That is Jacob and Hunter Weston. But Henniker, he had some serious concerns. And it's obvious from his diary that he didn't care for Shute very much.
No.
I put it down to the short time he was a brigade commander with the Royal Naval Division.
On the face of it, then, we've got, to me, as a layman, as a civilian, sounds like we've got a good plan there, not going to give the game away. We're going to have some light from the moonlight. The barrage is going to come down to stop the Germans from reinforcing afterwards and counterattacking. Having said that, we've also now started to hit upon divisions within the command, which would put doubt into my mind. But so far, it seems like we've got a good plan. What happens next? What goes wrong?
Well, Henniker says, "I'm more concerned about German machine guns opening fire in that 8 minute interregnum than I am of any German artillery barrage. But he was overruled.
Boy, shoot.
Okay. And he even recommended that, you know, they have Lewis guns in place to engage the German machine guns if they opened up from the position opposite. And that was also rejected. And
Right.
for the reason was that it would, I think Schutt was consulted, and his response was, Schutt said it'll cause too much confusion. And
Right.
Schutt, in his lecture that he gave in 1920, says, once you adopt a plan, you stick with
Stick
it.
with it. Right. Okay. Too rigid, though, isn't
And so it was
it?
decided that the operation would go in at 1:55 a.m. on the morning, on the morning of 2nd of December.
Yep.
And just wanted to go back. I didn't touch on this, but it's important to understand this is an attack from the Passchendaele salient. And so by the end of the campaign, there's this, it's the Passchendaele salient that's created,
Yeah.
very narrow. You
Yes.
can only crowd so many guns in there to support your operations.
So this salient then is a bulge in the line, and this is an unintended consequence of where the battle had ended in the November then.
And it makes sense because, for instance, I mentioned earlier that to the west of West Trozebeek, which is at the northern end in front of Pocklepot, it's a swamp.
Yes.
It's impassable to infantry.
Yeah.
So where this fighting is, and the Germans know, you know, they're always going to know where the British are going to attack because it's where they can get the best footing.
Yes,
And
yeah.
of course, it's on the high ground. But the Germans were aware that the British were going to attack,
Yeah, of
but they
course,
just didn't know when. And
yeah.
the reason I'm telling you this is that anything that was written before my book about this attack, and when I say that, like the 8th Division history or battalion history, and including, and in addition to that, some of the contemporary documents and diaries, they all say the same thing. They knew we were
I
coming.
knew we were
Well, they
coming.
did in a general sense, but they didn't know the day and the hour.
Yeah, but
They
they could
didn't know
prepare
that.
for it, couldn't they? They could
They did not know
prepare.
that.
And we've seen in history, I was thinking of some of the other battles, like at Bazentin Ridge and later on in the war, that when we had the best results is when we took the Germans completely by surprise. And that was obviously not going to be the case here. So my initial enthusiasm then, as a soldier that's there that day, if I pretend that's what I am, is now being tempered because I'm a little bit worried about commanders being at odds with each other and their plans. And now I've discovered that these Germans know at some point that we're going to be coming across that piece of no man's land. I'm starting to get nervous, Michael.
Well, what's interesting, Terry, is that they pulled it off. And what do I mean, what they pulled it off? They pulled off the forming up. The Germans were not aware that an attack was imminent. Now, how do I know this? Well, I know it from, you know, the aforementioned German sources from the archives, the regimental histories that I looked at. I'll give you an example. What it depicts is there's an account from a German officer. And he says that they saw people milling about in no man's land. Well, where the British position would have been in the Hudaberg Valley. And he said they thought it was a relief, one battalion relieving another. And it wasn't till they started to move. Now, on the right, the problem was a pillbox that was on the Passchendaele West Trozebeke Road called Teal Cottage. Now, why was that important? Teal Cottage was occupied by the British in late November 1917. In fact, I think the Germans abandoned it. And then on the 30th of November, the same day as the big German counteroffensive at Cambrai, the Germans launch a small counterattack and they recapture Teal Cottage. And no one is aware of it until the evening. Just holding the line before the attack was a battalion of the Enniskillen Fusiliers. I think it's the 2nd Battalion. And then one of their officers, a company officer, after dark, when you could expose yourself, he got out of his shell hole position and began to inspect the company line. And then he went out to Teal Cottage, which was occupied by a small garrison. And as he approached, they heard the shout in the British line, Verda! And he was gunned down, and that's how they found out. Now, why is it important? Because it's right on the boundary of the 32nd and the 8th Division. And so there were attempts to take it back, but it was too late.
That's always going to be the weakest point, isn't it, in any attack?
One memoir I read that I use, a very good one, the officer wrote, truly, the fox was among the hens when he talks about the occupation of that
Yeah, I can
particular
imagine.
pillbox. And so once the assault went in at 155, from what I understand, the machine guns in Teal Cottage opened up, and almost simultaneously at that moment on Vat Cottage's ridge, they saw was mirrors, as far as I can ascertain, the 11th Border Regiment advancing. But there's one other issue about why they were detected, and it makes me wonder, and this is the most important one, is that Schutte certainly valued night attacks and certainly insisted that, and correctly, I think, that there be some kind of relative light available, moonlight. Okay. Or if you felt like in the Second World War, what did they call it? Monty's moonlight. If it was cloudy, they aimed the searchlights and stuff. So the troops could, they could maintain their formation direction. So what unfortunately happened was, is that on the night of the 1st and 2nd of December, it snowed.
Oh, gosh.
Not a lot of snow, but enough to cover the
Over
ground
the ground, yeah.
instead.
Oh.
And of course, why is that important? And after the Second World War, Wehrmacht officers were really important to, the Western Allies, because there was the concern that we would be at war with the Soviet Union sometime soon. And like the rocket scientists, the German rocket scientists, these German officers that knew the Red Army were, brought in to share their knowledge. And there was one officer in particular that went to the Americans, and he wrote a book, which you can find online quite easily, called Night Attacks. And his pronouncement about these conditions, I can quote it. He says, when there is snow on the ground and the moon is full, this constitutes daytime conditions. And so even though they formed up undetected, in as much as the Germans didn't recognize an attack was
Yeah,
imminent,
they thought it was a
and
relief. Yeah.
with the left hand, with the right hand, well, it would be the left hand German division, the division opposite the 8th Division.
Yes.
It was the 25th Hessian Division. Their outposts seemed to have been completely taken by surprise.
Yeah.
But once they began moving and the German machine guns opened up,
Yeah.
that was it.
Yeah.
And there was nothing really that could be done, although attempts were made, I can tell you, to get this operation going again. And this would be particularly the case with Cameron Schutte, the 32nd Division commander. It's interesting to note, and he had been in the Rifle Brigade. And so in their Rifle Brigade chronicle, his obituary appears. And and they skirt around his character. He was a pretty ruthless guy, all right?
So I understand.
And did not suffer fools gladly.
Oh, no.
It said that when he commanded the 32nd Division, it was success every time, except, and it was this particular operation that I wrote about. And no doubt he would have been pleased, because he did ask about how it was going to be covered before he died in a letter to the official historian, James Edmund. It's reproduced at the end of the book in appendices, but in the appendices. But he asked how this operation was going to be treated amongst others,
Well,
and
he was
then
obviously worried
he
about it
added,
then, wasn't
these
he?
were all rather big shows, but it's ignored by the official history. They don't mention it at all.
So yes, the machine guns have opened up, the attack's broken down. What happened then? Did these poor men out in no man's land, obviously a lot of them are killed and wounded and presumably some taken prisoner. Did the survivors manage to get back? How many of them?
We go from right to left. You have the 25th Brigade of the 8th Division attacking. Now, that's under the command of Brigadier General Clifford Coffin, who was the first general officer to win a VC. He was somebody like Heneker who didn't think much of this operation. And his battalions from right to left were the 2nd Royal Berkshire, the 2nd Lincolns, and the 1st Rifle Brigade. Second, the 2nd Royal Berkshires went for They were putting out a flank guard and they went for the southern redoubt, which they captured briefly, but they were driven out again. The second Lincolns are making an attack on Venison Trench. And unfortunately, I think they would have overrun it, but in all that confusion and semi-darkness and whatever else, a shallow trench in front of Venison Trench was mistaken for that particular objective, and that's where most of them settled in. Although on the far right, there was a small entry made by a party that only held out until the evening and had to come back.
Yes.
The 1st Rifle Brigade attacked Northern Redoubt and failed completely,
Yeah.
got nowhere. And then with the 32nd Division, you have the 97th Brigade under Brigadier General Blacklock, very interesting character. He's commanding the 97th Brigade at this time, the 32nd Division. And on the right, you have the 2nd King's Own Yorkshire Light Infantry. And they actually overrun Hill 52, but local German counterattacks drive them back. Next, you have the 16th Highland Light Infantry. They advance slightly, but are halted. The Star Turn didn't do them any good as far as the higher authorities were concerned, was the 11th Border Regiment. And they advanced to their second objective. It was called Mallet Copse, and held those positions
But they're on their
for a
own.
time.
They're on their own. They've got no help on the
But they're
flanks, have they?
almost isolated because the 16th on their right and the 17th Highland Infantry on their left, which is going for a strong point, two strong points called Veal and Vat Cottages. They fail entirely. And then on the left, advancing to take the very western tip of the Vat Cottages Ridge is the 15th Lancashire Fusiliers. And they actually take most of their objectives, but
Wow.
the failures on the right, they aren't able to do much more with it. And I'll just put this in here now. When they're relieved that night, there's a mistake in the relief, and some of the positions they gained are abandoned. And
Right.
it wasn't recognized until the following morning. Very, very, very tragic. And so what eventually happens is, in a nutshell, once the attack breaks down, there are attempts to get forward, but the German machine guns achieve almost total dominance. Junior officers and NCOs become casualties, and you have a number of men that, without that kind of leadership, they really don't know what to do.
No.
Some of the advanced positions are held throughout the day, but then these, and I would describe them, they were effective enough, but lackluster German counterattacks still managed to push back where the 32nd Division front is on the left, to push back where the battalions did gain some ground, the Border Regiment, the King's Own Yorkshire Light Infantry. They pushed them back into the Hohenberg Valley again. So they're almost right back where they
Where they
started.
started
With the
from.
8th Division, they hold the positions in front of the German lines. What's interesting, though, is that once the assault fails, it appears that Honecker aren't interested in trying to get the operation going again. Not so Schutt. And what's interesting about Schutt is, you know where Schutt's headquarters is? If you know the Ypres salient, it's back along the Yser Canal.
Well, it's a long way
Okay?
away
So
then.
he's all the way west,
Yeah.
just to the north of Ypres. And he makes his way towards the front line. He gets as far as an intersection on the Zonnebeek Langemarck Road called Kansas Cross.
Oh, yeah.
And there he meets his brigadiers, and he's not happy. And I already knew he was unhappy. One of the things that obviously any author wants to trumpet his book, but one unique thing in the narrative that I wrote that I think readers will find unusual is that this will be a surprise, but by this time of the war, transcripts of wireless and telegraphy message and telephone conversations are kept. Now, they survived for the 8th Corps, but not for the 8th Division. And they didn't survive for the 2nd Corps, but they survived for the 32nd Division. And
Right.
so early on, it appears to Schutt back at his headquarters that the attack has been a success. Hill 52 has been captured, Mallet Copse, and there's also Vat cottages in British hands. And so Schutt is envisaging a pincer movement for the Germans that are holding up 17th Highland Light Infantry.
From what you said, it sounds to me that Schutt is aware that we have taken a couple of the objectives, which you mentioned a few minutes ago. But from that, he's assumed that the whole of the operation has been a success, not just the two areas that we've taken.
And he boasted about this. So, for instance, Major General Peter Strickland, who commanded the 1st Division on the 10th of November, I mentioned earlier, his division was on the right, excuse me, on the left of the 1st Canadian Division in that official last attack of Third Ypres. And in Strickland's diary, Strickland writes that Schutt paid him a visit and went on about how his brigade was, or his division was going to be successful in taking the objective that Strickland's division failed to do. So Schutt has a personal stake in this, in my
It's
opinion.
misplaced
And
optimism,
so
though, isn't
in the earlier part, before he came up the Kansas Cross, the transcript survived of conversations that he's having with Blacklock. And when he finds out that things are not where he believed that they were, you can just imagine, you really have some empathy for poor Blacklock
Yeah.
because Schutt is none too happy. And what eventually happens is that Schutt, when this is very typical of him, he wants to continue the attack. He
Yeah.
wants orders to bring a fresh brigade in, get the attack going again. Nothing like that comes from Heneker or Coffin,
But
but Schutt
also, would there be any
wants to
fresh
do
brigades
this.
or units? There wouldn't be any, surely, after everything that they've been through in the last 3 or 4 months, there wouldn't be any fresh units available. You wouldn't have thought.
Well, 32nd Division is fairly fresh because they were up on the coast. Now, that's not to say that they had an easy time up there. They didn't. They missed Third Ypres. And so they have lots of new drafts.
Yeah.
The battalions are fairly well up to strength. 8th Division took a hammering during Third Ypres, but for a time in the autumn, they're down in the Ploegsteert sector, which is quiet, and they're able to,
They could have been
refit
reserves. Yeah.
and get reinforcements. So both divisions are fairly fresh.
Yeah,
But
okay.
what should with these transcripts to be on the receiving end when he finds out, and so he wants to send in the 14th Brigade, which had been a one time a regular brigade attack to another division, and then at the end of 1915 they did that leavening where they, after Loos, and they put regular brigades into new army formations. So
Yeah,
the
for the
14th
experiment.
Under Brigade
Yeah.
under Lumsden, who wins a VC in 1918, Bridgel, chosen that they're going to renew the attack.
Okay.
However, they needed permission from the corps commander, who needed permission from the army commander. And what has it turned out? The army commander needed to reach out to GHQ. So what seemed necessary and important 24 hours before is now, as far as continuing this operation, it's denied.
Okay.
And it's denied because as Kigel, Haig's chief of staff, responds to Rawlinson, he mentions this. He says that we really can't afford any more needless waste of men, because it's obvious to everyone that
Not going to succeed.
the BEF and the Allies are going to have to go on the defensive in 1918 if Russia leads to war. And so that ended the operation.
When it comes to the number of casualties, how many, what was the casualty rate?
It was 1,000, as near as I can ascertain, and this is an estimate, 1,689 men. Unfortunately, the reports that I needed for that week from the German Fourth Army did not exist.
Right, so we don't know
But
the
looking
German
at the
casualty.
German regimental histories, and some of them don't record the casualties, but
Yeah.
my estimate for the German casualties, killed, wounded, and missing, is about 500 men.
And one of those
That's a
casualties,
guess.
one of those casualties people will know, the relative of one of those casualties is a man called John Cooksey, who has contributed to
Yes.
your book. And John was well known to everyone involved with the Western Front Association. He sadly died about 2.5, 3 years ago now. Because I believe it was his grandfather that was one of those casualties.
It was a great uncle.
Great uncle, yeah.
And it's how John and I got to know each other.
Yeah,
And
that's right. And I remember the last time John went to the Western Front, I was with him just before COVID it was, and he showed me his great uncle's name on the Tynecot Memorial there, and it was one of those moments that I'll never forget because, as I say, it was his last visit to the Western Front before he died not long after that.
now, John being John, he wrote an account of what happened to Private Albert Cooksey and his unit, which was the 2nd Battalion of the King's Own Yorkshire Light Infantry, the Coilies. He said that the battalion had set off after a hot meal from Irish Farm just east of Ypres, and they'd taken a final tea break at a junction called Kansas Cross. The march of 8 kilometres along a series of numbered or named wooden duckboard tracks on a winter's night through what was by then an almost flat, featureless, and cratered wasteland of standing water and clinging mud is almost impossible to imagine. Simply getting to their assembly positions must have been trying enough for the men, but then on arrival, having to steel themselves to go forward into that morass against an enemy who had shown no sign of giving way easily must have taken a form of courage and duty which I can barely grasp. John goes on to say in his account that the battalions on either side of the Coilies, the 2nd Rifle Brigade and the 16th Highland Light Infantry, lost direction, and everyone cut across each other's axis as they all struggled forward into the swamp. Absolute and utter chaos reigned, and it will come as no surprise to learn that the attack failed and their losses were very heavy. And John has researched how many losses there were within that battalion. Almost all of their officers and senior NCOs became casualties. 6 officers and 23 men were killed, and 120 men wounded, with 41 missing. That was what was reported at the time. And later on, John says that they revised the number of killed to 52. And amongst the missing was the pre-war regular soldier, his great uncle, Private Albert Cooksey. Cooksey's body is still missing. He has no known grave, and his name is on panel 108 of the Tynecot Memorial, along with the names of many of his comrades who went missing that night. And John wondered that not far away is the Passchendaele New British Cemetery, which was begun when many of the graves were brought in from the battlefields of Passchendaele and Langemarck after the armistice. And there are 2,101 burials in that cemetery not far from Tynecot that are from 1917. 1,600 of those are unidentified, and for years, John wondered whether one of those was his great uncle Albert.
And of those casualties, then, the figure that you just gave me, was that the total casualties or the amount of men that died? That was the total casualties, was it? For the
It's killed and missing.
killed and missing, right? Okay. And how many of those have a grave? And if they do have a grave, are they concentrated in Tynecot or Passchendaele New British Cemetery?
I can't tell you the percentage. There is a list of all the men
It's in your book,
at the end
isn't
of the book
it? People are gonna have to buy your
that
book, aren't they, I
perished in the
think?
operation, but they're in a number of places. The Pinecott, the most are in Passchendaele New Cemetery. Some of the wounded, of course, are buried in cemeteries where there would have been casualty clearing stations because
Perhaps
they
Lisson
died of
Hill,
their
places
wounds
like
and
that.
they didn't back down the line. Yes, that's correct. And I don't know, just recently, one of the casualties, an officer from the 16th Highland Light Infantry, was just identified. Just a few weeks ago, they put a replacement stone at Pinecott.
So that man that Michael was talking about was Second Lieutenant James Ferris, who was born in 1888 in Glasgow, and he joined up on the 11th of September 1914. And at the time of his death, him and his unit were attached to the 97th Trench Mortar Battery, and he and several others were operating from one of those pillboxes that Michael's been talking about, but in the rear of the line. The pillbox is recorded as taken a direct hit from a shell at around 4:15 in the afternoon on the 2nd of December 1917. Ferris, another officer, and 7 men from the other ranks were all killed. And his body wasn't found until 1920, and he could only be identified at that stage as a second lieutenant of the 16th Battalion. There were no other artifacts to indicate who he was, and he was buried in Tynecot as an unknown British officer. But as people do in recent years, there's been more research carried out on him, and it was accepted recently that this was indeed James Ferris, and the unknown headstone was replaced with a new headstone marking his final resting place in Tynecott with his name and these other personal details. So there we have it. Over 100 years after his death, another man has been identified and will always be remembered in Tynecott. One less man that's missing.
Oh, if we go to the battlefield now then, just to end with, what did we find? Because I understand there's a memorial there that you arranged. Is that all we can find?
It's an easy battle to comprehend if you know where you're going. If you have, for instance, the maps from my book, you should be able to identify the features. Southern Redoubt, where Venison Trench was, Northern Redoubt, that position, Hill 52, that Cottage Ridge, and someone. Yeah. There is a small memorial. It's at a place owned by a couple. It's where the German lines would have been. And it's quite modest, stainless steel plaque with an orientation map. And it's on a post. Yeah. And some local people with interest have gone and they've maintained it over the years. It was dedicated on the 2nd of December, 2017, in a special ceremony.
Yeah, 100 years. Oh, right. Well, I'm certainly going to go and find that next time we go over.
So before we go on and talk about Michael's next project, let's have another look of what it was like to be there on that battlefield the night of the 2nd of December 1917. There's an officer called Nettleton who was serving with the 2nd Rifle Brigade, and he said this: "Back at Battalion HQ, we were out of sight of the enemy by 8 o'clock. I was sent out to look for some more accommodation to relieve the congestion in and around our pillbox. I found another pillbox about 200 yards down the road, but it was choked with dead Germans. They must have been caught by the Canadians and bombed as they were trying to escape. We had to pull out more than a dozen corpses before we could get into it. However, when we got it cleared, it gave us room to sit down and have breakfast, and as there was nothing anyone could do outside, we passed a day in comparative peace." Only comparative, though. There was shelling going on all the time, and the Boche seemed to have got our pillbox taped. One shell hit the back wall of the pillbox and burst along the trench outside, causing several casualties. One man caught most of the blast and had one side of his body ripped to pieces. While the stretcher bearers were trying to bandage him up, he was screaming and groaning, but not because of his terrible wounds. He got a splinter in the foot away from the side that had been blasted, and it appeared to have broken his toe, and it was that he was groaning about. I suppose the side of his body that had been torn to bits was so numb that he didn't realise what had happened. But it sounded odd to hear him crying, "Oh, my toe! My toe!" when that was such a minor part of his injuries. Luckily, we were able to evacuate him without having to wait for nightfall, but I don't think he can have survived.
And the other thing which you touched on as we were chatting is that you're writing another book. And this sounds fascinating because for me, I've only been to Newport once up there. You mentioned that because I'm from Northampton, and many of our town and county men were either taken prisoner or were killed in that battle. So tell us about that then, Michael.
Well, absolutely. I thought of that when I saw where you live, the 1st Northampton Regiment. So what happened was that in the summer of 1917, the British took over on the Belgian coast. It was a place that the French had occupied for most of the war since the autumn of the autumn of 1914. And so what you had is in Ypres, if you had the British, then you had the Belgian army, and then you had a French army corps occupying that coastal sector, which would, you know, from the coast, Newport, a little farther inland to the south. And so in the summer of 1917, part of Haig's plan, and contingent upon the success of the 3rd Ypres offensive, that is, so the capture of the Passchendaele Ridge and threatening Roulers and Thoreau, important railway hubs, was an advance by the British along the Belgian coast and the landing of a division behind the German lines.
Because we're trying to capture the ports, is that right? We're kind of trying to get the ports, that's the whole idea.
Capture Zeebrugge and Zeebrugge, and also with the connection with the Northamptonshire Regiment is that for the first on the right around Newport, you had the 32nd Division holding the line from Moonlight Massacre attack.
Yeah.
And on the left, on the coast, you had the 1st Division, 3rd Brigade, I believe. You had holding the line on the east bank of the Yser Canal. So the canal was at their back. And the only way you could get to the other side was over three bridges. You had the First Northamptons and the Second King's Royal Rifle Corps. And the Germans, once they got wind that the British had taken over up there, they weren't fools. They knew something was up. And for reasons, as far as I can ascertain, that they didn't want there to be a similar backlash, they left the French holding that east bank of the Yser, that bridgehead, since the end of 1914, even though it enfiladed their position to the south. But once they got wind that the British were up to something, they brought up masses of guns and crack marine regiments from the newly formed 3rd Marine Division, and they launched a general attack. It's considered by some to be the first real combined arms operation.
So this isn't fair.
And
This isn't fair, is it? Because we're supposed to be attacking the Germans and pushing them back into the sea, and they've beaten us to it by the sound of it, haven't they? They've before we've had a chance
the
to do
bear
that.
blew first.
Yeah, that's not on, is
And
it?
interestingly enough, this adjutant of the Second King's Royal Rifle Corps wrote a letter to his father back in England after the attack, because the both battalions, I mean, they were destroyed mostly as prisoners. It's probably the largest haul of British prisoners until Kaiser
Yeah,
Schock.
they're
Okay.
surrounding them, aren't
And I have photos of them being marched through Ostend with their steel helmets,
they? Yeah.
and they're and then also they're temporarily housed in a school which still stands. But this adjutant wrote a letter to his father, who was too old to serve, but was, serving at home, and basically says, "We were hung out to dry. We were put in an impossible situation."
Yeah.
And this ended up on Rawlinson's desk. Rawlinson was in command up there. And there's a wonderful document where Rawlinson has annotated the report, or the letter that the son wrote to the father, and he's annotated it, what he thinks is valid, what he thinks is invalid. And I don't know if you remember the program, I believe from the late 90s, by the late Richard Holmes, about the Western Front. And
Yes.
he and there's a line he says in there: "It's very difficult to like great war generals."
Yeah,
And then he goes
yeah.
on to why that. Well, the
Yeah.
corps commander up there was Lieutenant General Duquesne. And according to accounts that I've read from the survivors of the King's Royal Rifle Corps, he basically, they were all brought together and blamed them for the failure.
Yeah.
"Oh, you let us down." I mean,
Well, what we'll have to do then is
it's a stretch. I mean, it really is.
it
But
is.
this particular attack has been written about a lot. I have such an embarrassment of riches as far as sources go, but it's never been written about as a whole. It's been touched on by other authors. There's some good coverage in some memoirs, but I'm going to give it the Moonlight Massacre treatment. It's going to have the same
Brilliant.
approach to
I
it.
look forward to that. And what's the book going to be called?
It's called The Dunes Disaster.
Okay, and when will it be published? You haven't got a publication date yet?
I'm thinking probably in 2025,
Right, a
which
while
is
away then.
a improvement on a Moonlight Massacre, which was, as I said earlier, 11 years of my life
Yeah.
from master's degree to publication.
Well, perhaps what we could do then, if it was okay with you, next year when it comes to the anniversary again of that particular battle up at Newport, if we could do another podcast, and it'll be like in lieu
Oh,
of
I'd
what
be
we're
happy
doing,
to, of
won't it?
course.
Yeah, that'd be brilliant.
I'd be happy
Absolutely
to,
fantastic.
absolutely, sir. Yes.
Yeah, and it's amazing. I really thank you very much for doing this today, because I know from what people have told me, when I meet, you go out and you meet people that listen to the podcast, and they take them along. They take along these podcasts on their phones, their electronic devices, and they go to the battlefields and they listen to the podcast as they're walking across the battlefield. And in this case, the Moonlight Massacre, the battlefield is so small, they'll be able to do that in just a few minutes, won't they? Or even quicker if they do it in their car. So it really does, it is used, and obviously your book, The Moonlight Massacre, it's published by Hellion and Company, and it can be, people can still get it, can't they? It's still in print. You've got a second edition, and it's available in all the usual bookshops,
Absolutely.
online sites.
It's pretty easily available anywhere. Yeah, it's readily available out there. The maps are quite useful. And when visiting that particular battlefield, it's quite off the beaten path.
It is. I've
So
been there.
you won't encounter many people about.
No. Excellent. Okay. Well, I'll let you go. But once again, thank you very much for joining us on the podcast, House and the Battlefields.
And we'll speak to you again next year. Thank you, Michael. So before we go, as I was listening back and editing the podcast, I thought to myself that we haven't looked closely enough at some of the casualties, some of the individual soldiers that fell in battle on that night. So I'm going to put that right now just to finish with a couple of stories. And the first one is about Captain H.R. Ford. And he was serving with the King's Own Yorkshire Light Infantry. And he's one of the few that does have a grave or a known grave. He's buried in Tynecott in Plot 9, Row E, Grave 23. His body was discovered after the war. Now, his name was Henry. He was born in June 1895, educated at Clifton College and the Royal Military College at Sandhurst. And he was gazetted as a second lieutenant in January of 1915. And then at the end of the year, on the 3rd of December 1916, he was promoted to captain and served for about a year, just over a year on the Western Front, having arrived out on the Western Front in October of 1916. And report says that he was buried where he fell. A brother officer wrote about him, "It was an awful blow to us all, for he was looked upon by everyone as a true friend. He's a great loss to the battalion." Another officer said, "A brave and gallant officer has been taken by God. But he did his work, and he was a man amongst men when danger lurked about." And an officer in another regiment knew him as well, and he said all his company officers had been killed, and he was rallying his men when a German sniper hit him in the head, and poor lad, he was killed at once. And he'd been awarded the Military Cross in April 1917. His citation said that he led his men in the attack with great gallantry and captured an enemy line of strong posts together with 40 prisoners. And he'd previously done fine work. Another one of those officers that fell not that night was a 22-year-old Second Lieutenant William Ridgway, who was attached to the 11th Border Regiment. And he was known as Will, and he came from a village of Tingewick, which is in Buckinghamshire. By trade, he was a journalist. He'd worked in Northampton and Peterborough, also for the Cambridge Advertiser as a sports reporter. Before going out to the Western Front, Will returned home to his parents, two sisters, and his brother, who was just 6 years old. His name was Fred. Fred said, "I remember him coming home on leave during Christmas 1916. He looked very smart in his officer's uniform." He was gazetted in March 1917 and arrived at the Western Front shortly afterward. So over the top he goes, and he's never seen again. He's remembered on the Tynecott Memorial, and a letter was received shortly afterwards at the family home in Buckinghamshire, and it said, "It is with a heavy heart that I have to inform you that your son is wounded and missing after the fight at Ypres. He gallantly led his platoon in the attack and was seen to fall at the moment of success. The enemy counterattacked and retook the advanced position, and it was not possible to get to your son. It is just possible that the Germans may have attended to him, and he's now in a German hospital, and I pray it is so. Your boy was always a fearless and gallant soldier, loved by everyone who knew him, and your great anxiety is shared by all of us." Now, Will's brother, Fred, he was only 7 years old when his brother died, but he never forgot him. There was, 16 years between them, 15, 16 years between them. All through Fred's long life, he didn't forget his older brother. How could he forget him? And Fred lived to be 90 years old, but just before he died in the year 2000, he made a pilgrimage to Belgium. He went to Tynecott. He found the memorial, and he looked at his brother Will's name on the Tynecott Memorial. And we can only wonder what went through his mind on that memorable day for him. And the next man I wanted to talk about is John Scrivener, Second Lieutenant. He was attached to the 15th Battalion of the Lancashire Fusiliers. He was born in January 1897, and in civilian life he was a bank clerk. He enlisted in the Royal Lancaster Regiment in October 1914, and after a period of training with the Officer Training Corps, was gazetted as a second lieutenant in the Lancashire Fusiliers. He served in France and Flanders from January 1917, and his commanding officer wrote about him after he'd been killed in the attack. "We all feel that we've lost an officer who cannot easily be replaced. He was so keen on his work and so brave in action." And a battalion chaplain said about him, "He was so keen and enthusiastic and as brave as any man can hope to be.
We played games together, so I saw quite a lot of him and grew to love him for his straight, upright, fearless character. I've lost a good friend, and another officer wrote about him. He died the death of a gallant soldier, nobly defending the traditions peculiar to our race. He died winning, his death an example of sacrifice and devotion to duty. So this week, as usual, we'll end the podcast by remembering all of those gallant men that fell in that dreadful battle, no more dreadful than any of the others, but dreadful all the same. Most of those men have no known grave. They're remembered on the Tynecott Memorial. Many of them are still there, but we'll remember them tonight, as usual, by the playing of The Last Post.